When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Come on. Welcome to Money Savage REI, and welcome our guest, the strong and powerful Scott Chopin. Scott, welcome.
Hey, George, great to be here.
Thank you for having me on. Yeah. Scott is the founder and CEO of the Urban Pacific Group. They're real estate development veterans, helping investors achieve superior recession-resistant long-term results. Again, excited to have you on. Scott, tell us a little bit about your personal life, some more about your work, and why you do what you do.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So basically have a family background in real estate development. I've spent the entirety of my career doing real estate development, even differentiated from investing in real estate, although we do invest in our own projects. We're really exclusively a developer. I've spent now close to 35 years basically, you know, honing my skills in the space. Family background. I'm married to my wife, Becky. She and I have been together and married for 27 years.
Nice.
Three kids, 19, 17, and 13. So oldest is in college at USC. And then my younger son is in high school, and my daughter, our youngest, she's in junior high school. Really my family is what is my existential purpose. Like, why do I do what I do? Of course, I'm like anybody. I want to, you know, build an identity in the marketplace to be successful and you know, productive and profitable in business operations. But, you know, every day that I go to work, that I do what I do, it's really to take care of my family, both, you know, now, you know, in the immediate, you know, present, but also in the long-term future. And, you know, I think it's, you know, it took me many years to really like know that, like have it be something I thought about consciously. I mean, I was always oriented towards family, but it finally dawned on me probably 8 or 10 years ago that I go, oh, like this is really why I do it. I mean, you know, I mean, there's a certain amount of ego, I suppose, and wanting to be, you know, successful in what you do and what you undertake, but all that goes out the window when you go, really, what the decision making metric is, you know, how can I, you know, I need to take care of others in business while I take care of my family. So that's sort of my background.
Nice. I appreciate that. So 35 years in the real estate industry, in development. Has it all been in a certain region?
You know, so 35 years when I have family background, George, where basically my Uncle Mike and my dad, Carrie, were both real estate developers in their own right. And so I basically started at 16 years old. I'd get up in the mornings before I went to high school, and I'd drive to my dad's apartment projects in particular. I'd pick up trash, you know, super sexy, right?
Sure.
probably if you'd asked me at the time, I would have told you I like hated every minute of it. And I probably was a terrible, probably an awful trasher.
A bad trash picker-upper.
but it informed me over several major milestone decision making, you know, time periods in my younger years. You know, I got out of high school, didn't necessarily have a specific, you know, intention to go to college. college or even necessarily what my career was, which sounds silly because I come from a family of very successful people, but you know, being 18, you know, sort of, you know, does that to you.
Yeah.
So I worked for a couple of years in the construction trades and learned a lot about how all the work I did was on new construction apartment buildings, which, you know, came from, you know, help that my dad gave to find that job. And that taught me several things of what I didn't want to do. I didn't want to be in construction, you know, good people. And we still do a lot of that work. You know, we work with people who are in the trades and in the construction industry, but wasn't going to be what I wanted to do exclusively. And then, you know, about that age of 18 or 19, I read several books that really sort of brought home for me finally what my uncle and my dad did relative to deal making, right? Like I understood sort of the background of development. I saw what they did. Hey, you build buildings, you find land, you rent out offices or apartments. But these books finally opened up my thinking. I go, oh, this is what an entrepreneur is. Like, you know, you find a deal, you add value, you sell it for more than it costs you, right? Very fundamental, like, you know, and really what ultimately sort of motivated me to then pursue real estate development as a career. And from really that point on, George, it was like I knew I needed to go to college. I needed to get a certain degree, you know, business administration and finance is what I picked, what I thought was going to be most applicable to that. And then, you know, worked for several years, you know, for other companies, learning the profession of real estate development, project management. And then at 32 was the time period that I decided was time to go out on my own and really run my own company, which has been Urban Pacific now for 21 years this coming March.
Nice. It's always cool to learn people's journey. So, all right. So tell us specifically what it is that Urban Pacific does.
Yeah, so being a real estate developer, you know, we find land either vacant or underutilized, and we design and build buildings that, in our instance, we are an apartment developer. So we build new construction apartment projects, and we focus specifically in the workforce housing domain. So we build apartments that, in fact, we have a unique product called Urban Townhouse, or UTH for short, which was really predominantly designed and built to rent to families. You know, think a working class family in Southern California is where we're headquartered, but any major urban high cost housing market, which California is like the, you know, the top, you know, of that pile of expensive marketplaces. So we really are predominantly working to build apartments to serve multi-generational families. In fact, we build a 5-bedroom, 4-bath townhouse rental product that basically sort of lives like a house is the way we say it. It lives like a house, but rents, you know, like an apartment unit. And it allows us to serve these families, you know, in relative affordability. And I'd say relative because, of course, that depends on, you know, who the family is in the market, specific micro market that they're in. But the intention is to give them an environment and a housing unit that allows them to economic share amongst multiple income earners and live multi-generationally, which is not typical for the apartment development, you know, industry. They're not serving that demographic. And then more recently, during this coronavirus era, we've actually had a huge increase in working professional roommates. So not your younger population, although there's some of those folks, but these would be people that are in their late 20s and 30s that are working professionally. Their companies have released them from working in a specific geographic location. They can now work virtually. And so they become what I call location agnostic. And in fact, they're predominantly forming the roommate groups around some, you know, pre-existing friendship group or, you know, people that enjoyed living together that now can go live together because their companies have all gone virtual. And so they don't care where they care where they live, but sure. In other words, they don't have to live in city X or city Y. And so they're forming these groups and then they pick some, you know, place that they want to live. And we're attracting them because we have these 5-bedroom units. So what we're having is we'll get 3 or 4 professionals working together and they'll, you know, 3 people lives in a unit, 3 bedrooms used for living, and then they have the 2 extra bedrooms for work from home space. So we've had a vast increase in acceleration in that environment. So we always anticipated that, you know, in a recession, our product would be attractive to people that wanted an economic share amongst multiple earners, which in our minds was always families and still is. But this roommate group, you know, the economic sharing lifestyle is the same. And you know, it's typical for humans to, you know, live that way, to live together and share incomes and expenses during recessionary periods. So we're seeing really very significant uptick in our you know, business plan in that environment, in this environment right now.
How interesting. When did you sort of make the decision to focus on that urban townhouse model?
So about 4 years ago is when we really started thinking about it. So 2016, 2017, we had been developing a different product type that was more oriented to studio and one bedroom units. So think, you know, young working professionals that were moving to the city center, downtown areas, great product, great demographic. But in 2017, we started to see a real big surge in new supply from really big, you know, small, middle-sized companies. There's a lot of product coming on to the marketplace and really gearing up to come in the future. And so that really, you know, we've always wanted to operate in a contrarian mode wherever we could. And so, you know, just given my background in affordable housing and market rate housing, I knew the story of families in need of housing that suited families, right? You know, think about it, a studio or one bedroom doesn't fit families. They would never choose the lifestyle, just the living format isn't cohesive for them. But also those projects are very expensive, right? And so if you're a working family with four or six or eight people and you do rent either by choice or by default, then, you know, you start to look around the marketplace and there's very limited supply of product that really fits these, you know, this family lifestyle, right? Multi-generational. So we started to look and go, what can we be doing that's different than what everybody else is doing so we can move away from the crowd, so we can not be, you know, surrounded by huge amounts of competition. You know, what's a product that's in high demand and low supply? So we really arrived at this UTH model. You know, after a few months of really research and working on a few early projects that sort of informed how we could build it. And really, once we really, after about the first couple projects, it really cemented our thinking. They go, this is a long-term space to occupy in the market, you know, market niche. You know, it has this great social impact story of helping families, now helping, you know, roommates. It's not in huge supply. I mean, there's not a lot of people that are going to do five bedroom units, right? It's just wholly uncontested. There's a few people at a low level that play in that space, but, you know, we're the only ones that I can see that are doing it at scale and really growing at scale also. And so we basically about 3 years ago, you know, just went solely and exclusively to the UTH model. And in fact, we're working on raising a real estate equity fund that should be, you know, out in the public domain in the next 60 days that would finance an existing portfolio of projects that we've already developed and will hold long term, and then roll several new projects. And the intention is to have a supply of capital with a long term, really 5 to 7 year window of time to invest. And then, you know, we'll, you know, structure these so we hold them in perpetuity. Really, for all intents and purposes, you know, we want to hold these projects forever. We think the story of multi-generational living and economic sharing in California particularly is going to be the story for a very long time. And so we've committed really, you know, our entire company and all our resources towards that business plan.
Nice. Well, I think it's exciting, and it seems like any time that you can find something that's in high demand and low supply, that seems like a pretty good idea.
Yeah, that came from one of those books I mentioned earlier, right? Like, you know, Buy Low and Sell High.
Right. But obviously, nobody else thinks that it's a good idea, or they just can't figure out how to do it. What is it?
Yeah, great question. I mean, we don't. I don't, you know, like my role as the CEO is a lot about strategy and innovation, right? Like what's the next, you know, phase? What's the next step? What can we be doing to stay ahead of the competition, right? And I don't say that nobody will do five bedrooms. Now, a couple answers to your question. One is all the institutional developers and builders and investors won't really get into this domain in a big way because it's so far on the end of the spectrum as far as unit type, Now, that's not to say a developer won't put some larger bedroom count units into their project, but they wouldn't do it exclusively like we are. So, you know, certain level of commitment. I think that it's just because it's so extreme, institutions and social capital sources aren't built to be extreme. They're, in fact, built to be the middle of the road. You know, they have fiduciary duty. You know, they want to produce returns, but they also don't want to screw it up and invest in something that's so extreme as to be, you know, like unknown or untested. Now, we, like, because we do raise capital, and that's an ongoing, you know, effort of ours, you know, we look to, you know, make the product competitive and compelling from a narrative standpoint. Like, why would an investor invest in this? Oh, stable families, right? Strong social networks that keep these families local, you know, low supply, high demand, right? Long-term future of like not enough product to meet the needs of it, right? And so I think we'll see an uptick in modern income housing and workforce housing and you know, multi-generational housing. But those are like small niche parts of the business generally when you look at the total marketplace. So that will always be the case. Right. Institutions are not experimental. That'll keep them out of the space. And then, you know, we just need to contend with those people that do get comfort with the extreme nature of the product type. And our job, my job, is to innovate, to continue to stay ahead of the crowd. Maybe new build technologies, maybe different markets. Maybe we expand, you know, instead of families, we think of roommates that work from home, right? And that's an observation we saw in the marketplace naturally. We go, can we, you know, do things in our business plan that you know, can make that more conducive to, you know, expanding a business plan, right? Staying ahead of the crowd ultimately. So it's never that it will never happen, or it's not, how can I put this? You know, competition will come. And it's just our job to basically continue to innovate, stay ahead of that. But I think, you know, in relative terms, we're going to stay in this workforce housing space, because I do think in general terms, it's underserved from what I spoke about before. But also, I think just the narrative and the mental model that most institutions have, right? If you think, look at the mainstream media, you know, they're like, oh, workforce housing, you know, it doesn't work, or there's no way to make it work, right? And I, you know, I read a lot and I hear those narratives and I go, great. I mean, we would love more families to be served by workforce housing. There's plenty of demand to go around. Like, we would never be able to fulfill even a small portion of it. So I think that, you know, generally growth in the marketplace is welcomed. But at the same time, it's such an extreme niche that I don't see that a mainstream, you know, the crowd won't come into that space.
Right.
Generally.
Makes sense. I like it. Well, Scott, Savage Nation is ready for your difference-making tip. What do you have for them?
You know, the place I've been spending a lot of time thinking about is, you know, what I call networks of capability, right? So we all know the term networking, and I'm not meaning that exactly, although that's part of it. It's really to think about it in a new way. So we're in this new environment of technology acceleration, right? Coronavirus has come. You know, we've moved, you know, what would have been a 10-year technology adoption cycle, and we've moved it into, you know, 5 months or whatever. You know, Zoom would be an example of that. And so what that does, that should throw, and we're in this story, people into building their networks around capabilities and not convenience, right? So convenience, you know, in the old days when you lived in the village, you know, you had the local candle maker and the local butcher and the person who made clothes, and they were in your village. And so you transacted with them because they were convenient, right? And what I call the third industrial revolution, which would be predating computers, you know, you had people in your local community, right? Or your local industry of, you know, I sell widgets in the United States and I'm in the Widget Conference of America, you know, group. Now, technology, computers, and the internet allow us to basically transact globally, right? I think everybody's aware of that story. But what I think is sort of a new thinking is that we're not limited to our local networks or networks of convenience. We really can go to any nation around the globe and find the best of the best in that particular, you need to transact with somebody who edits videos. I don't need to have somebody who's in the U.S. I can go to India or the Philippines, or, you know, I can, like, hire somebody who lives in, you know, middle America in a rural town who has great skills but doesn't live in Southern California, which normally would be your, you know, the way you'd look at it. So really to be oriented around networks of capability and to really work to build strong, powerful networks in a way that advantages now from this you know, global, you know, connectivity, you know, coordination, cooperation methodology. That's been really, if I think about it now, George, like my job over the, you know, the last few years, plus really the rest of my career will be to, you know, amplify and accelerate those networks of capability to upgrade our company's capability to execute on real estate projects, to, you know, find new groups of investors, right, who like the story of what we're producing, you know, in the workforce housing space, and to really just to continue to build that, you know, network of both internal, you know, people work for us directly, but external also. And, you know, we're making moves constantly to figure out how to upgrade the teams and the people that we work with. You know, we got to take care of the people who are with us already. So it's, but, you know, sometimes like you and I talked about, you know, pre-interview is, you know, sometimes you have to quit people and companies and processes and markets to be successful. So, you know, there's building powerful networks and there's quitting, you know, less powerful networks. And it sounds harsh as I say it. But the reality is if you don't do that as a company and as an organization, as a manager or CEO, you know, those people that you stick with from a loyalty standpoint could drag you down, right? Maybe it's not like fatal, but, you know, if you got a person who holds your growth back, you know, they're thwarting your taking care of your family, they're thwarting your employees taking care of their families. So building networks of capability and quitting, they go together.
Well, I think that is great stuff that definitely gets come on. Scott, thank you so much for coming on. Where can Savage Nation learn more about you? How can people engage with you and Urban Pacific?
Yeah, no, thank you for that. So for your listeners, I would offer if folks want to go to our website, www.urbanpacific.com/ebook. We've got an ebook offer of how to survive and thrive in a recession, which I think is an appropriate, timely conversation to be having. And this ebook really is a you know, sort of a reflection and lessons learned from the 2008 recession that, you know, I was managing this company and through that time period, and I think very applicable. So if folks want to go there, get the ebook, that will put you on our email list, which we'll put out every Saturday. We put out an email, and our emails are really around, you know, market updates, economic trends, you know, some of the thinking that you see, this network of capability and quitting conversations. There's sort of that knowledge in there. People want to go to the website and go to our investor education section. Got a lot of information there. And then go to our contact page, and our entire team email and phone numbers are on there. And, you know, we can get people can get a hold of us that way. Email is best.
Love it. Well, Savage Nation, if you enjoyed this as much as I did, show Scott your appreciation and share today's show with a friend who also appreciates good ideas. Go to urbanpacific.com/ebook and get that information about managing through recessions. Go to urbanpacific.com, the investor education page, as well as the contact page. Check out all the great resources. Thanks again, Scott.
All right, George. Thank you so much.
And until next time, keep fighting the good fight, because we are all in this together. I know how important it is for me to hit reset, to refocus, reprioritize, and even reprogram myself every quarter or so in order to make sure that my mind, my body, and my money are where they need to be. These days, we are all going hard constantly with so many demands on our time, our attention. That's why I created the Strive Online Bootcamp, to be able to take a step back, to ensure that we're optimized in three key areas of our lives, our minds, our bodies, and our money. And I'd love for you to come with me on this two-week journey. You can click on the link in the notes of the show, or you can go to strivedetox.com, check out the program. I'd love to have you a part of it.